Welcome, Father. It's good to have you in the studio today.
That's good to be back again.
It is good. It's a nice day to talk about church history. Not that any of them aren't. I guess they all are for me.
That's right. So we've been just introducing ourselves to the earliest of early modern church history. We've been looking a little bit at the Avignon Papacy, which is an absolutely fascinating time. It's sort of a different way of doing church in the sense that it wasn't in Rome, but you have to understand, but we always remember that Rome was very, very dangerous at that time.
Right.
And so it was not, it would not have been conducive to run church governance, unfortunately, from Italy at that point. And so Avignon presented a more peaceful situation. And so we'll be looking today at some incidences that happened. If you remember that the reason why the conclave that elected Clement V elected him was because he was a friend of the King of France, and the hope was that he could use his personal diplomacy, which he had great skill at, as we'd seen last week in different other areas, to bring about a, well, to use a French term, a rapprochement between France and the papacy. That was their hope, and that didn't always work out. And the most tragic example of that not working out is the suppression of the Knights Templar, how that takes place, and the ineffectiveness of the Pope in order to try to rectify that.
Briefly, instruct us again on the Knights Templar. I know that they were kind of started with the Crusades, right?
It is, yeah. It's a fascinating group of men. They had organized back in the 1100s, and they were known as the Order of the Poor Knights of the Temple of Solomon.
Okay.
Hence the name the Templars.
Okay.
And their headquarters, in fact, was on the top of Temple Mount. They were the occupants of that, some of the most sacred soil in the world for three religions, both Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, both hold that in great respect. That was their headquarters, and of course today that same site now is the Temple Mount.
Is
the Dome of the Rock? Is an Islamic site.
I was going to say who has possession now?
Yeah, okay, that's right. And as I say, they were religious soldiers. This seems very strange to us today how this would be, but it was. These were men who dedicated their lives to protecting pilgrims on their on the road from the Mediterranean at the port of Jaffa to Jerusalem, and they lived by the rule of Saint Augustine. So they lived as though they were Augustinians.
Okay.
They had monks, they had priests in this order. They were not allowed to fight. The other monks who were soldiers, that's what they did. So if you could imagine that in the monasteries all throughout Europe, you'd have some monks who were bakers and others who were brewmasters and others had vineyards and others took care of sheep, and well, these particular men, they fought. They were knights, and yet monks at the same time.
Because it was difficult travel through there.
It was dangerous. There's no doubt about it. And remember that after the First and Second Crusades, that you have a kingdom, a Western kingdom, a Latin kingdom established in what is today the Holy Land. And in fact, there was a king appointed to rule over that, King Baldwin, and he certainly welcomed the Knights Templar as an important element for the defense of that area. This was a lawless area also. Go ahead.
Didn't they also serve some treasury?
Yes, they did. Besides the military work that they did, they sort of backed into this. And here's a situation in which the Knights Templar had houses all over Europe.
Okay.
Now, these are armed knights, so their houses are safe.
Safe houses.
Yeah, right. But, well, they were safe not so much for people as much as for money. If you were traveling, for instance, let's say you were a merchant and you were traveling from Paris, and you were going to Cairo or Damascus. Damascus would be a good example. And you wanted to go to Damascus in order to buy, I don't know, Persian rugs.
Okay.
Okay. It would be not safe for you to travel from Paris all throughout Europe, waking your way all the way to Damascus, carrying all that money.
Mm-hmm.
So what you would do is you would go to a Knights Templar monastery. You would give them the cash, and then they would write a note saying to the knights at this other particular place, headquarters, that you had given so much money to them, and then they would give you that money. It's the beginnings, really, of what
banking.
We call banking or commercial paper.
Oh, okay.
You know,
uh-huh, sure.
Checks. And so that's what you would do. You would travel to this other place. Well, if you were waylaid along the way and somebody, you know, said, give me your money or your life, you go, well, I don't have any money. I just have this note from the Knights Templar. They go, well, that's no good. Move. Get out of here. And then they would go after somebody else that had some wealth. So you could get to Damascus, get your money, and then go buy your goods. So it made life easier. In the process of all of this, of course, the knights then had the money in order to use. And then another thing, too, is a lot of people were very grateful for the service that the knights gave, certainly as far as protection, but also their other services throughout Europe. And so often people would give bequests to the knights. And so over a period of time, the knights had a lot of money in order to do their particular ministry.
Okay.
You know, and so they became quite wealthy. And there were people who were jealous of that.
Oh, mm-hmm.
First of all, there were a lot of bishops who were jealous of it because for two reasons. First of all, they were a papal order protected directly by the Pope.
Okay.
And their service was directly to the Pope. And so the bishop, if you had a monastery with the Knights Templar headquarters in your diocese, you had no control over that that property. They would have every right to raise money, have capital campaigns in your diocese.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, would make your own diocese poorer for
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that element of independence did not endear them to the knights or even to other monasteries. And then, of course, as I see, they were rich pickings for a ruthless king. And don't we have a ruthless king at this time? You
right.
know, Philip the Fourth, mm-hmm. Philip the Unfair, fair by complexion, unfair in the way he went around doing things. And so Philip, if you remember, at the installation of at the ceremonies of the installation of Pope Clement the Fifth, he kind of throws a dead fish into the whole ceremonies by taking the Pope aside and telling him, by the way, I've got evidence that the Knights Templars are a heretical group and they are practicing black masses and all kinds of things. Well, of course, none of that's true. And the Pope was shocked. And so I just can't believe that. And the king says, well, let me tell you. You know, and so here you have this kind of standoff. All of a sudden, then, in 1307, one dark and stormy night, the French launched an attack that was set up by the Chancellor of France, Guillaume de Nogaret, who we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the guy that really roughed up and led to the death of Pope Boniface VIII. Well, this fellow launches an attack on the houses, especially in Paris, but all the houses of the Knights Templar, and disarms them overnight. It's done on October the 13th. It happens to be a Friday. And from thereafter, Friday the 13th has just never been a lucky day. Massive arrests all throughout France. Something like 50, possibly as many as 100 knights were rounded up. And they included the general, the grand master of the order, Jacques de Molay. There's some really interesting books if people want to read more on this. One of them I would really highly recommend is called The Knights Templar and Their Myth. And I'm going to quote this a little bit later on. This is Peter Parkner, And Peter Partner has done some really good work on the Knights Templar and also on the myth that grows into what is Freemasonry.
Oh.
Okay. The other one that is not so much, is not as good a history, but it is really intriguing and just really a fun read, is called Dungeon, Fire, and Sword.
Okay.
And the subtitle is The Knights Templar and the Crusades, but it also talks about the suppression. And the author of this is John J. Robinson.
Okay.
But I would really, if you want to read something entertaining and engaging, read Robinson. Uh-huh. But if you really want the scoop
the
on
truth.
What really, well, yeah.
Not necessarily, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the straight, you know, mm-hmm. the skinny
more
on
the historical.
On what happened. Yeah. You would get a hold of Peter Partner.
Okay.
and read his, and he's got a couple other books out too. But this is this event that takes place on Friday the 13th of 1307 with the arrest of these knights. In fact, Clement later on says that he believed as many as 2,000 knights were arrested in France alone. That's probably an exaggeration. There might have been 2,000 knights in France at the time. But certainly the first sweep took out the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intention to do that. The Templars should have been protected by Pope Clement. Yeah, he should have challenged the king right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, we're dealing with a diplomat with a diplomatic mindset and personality. And so instead of confronting and challenging, which of course is a sort of a Boniface VIII kind of an approach, instead he looks for ways of nuances and negotiations and all of those sorts of things. The chancellor, Guillaume de Nogeret, finds a traitor. Finds an ex-knight who is willing to come up and spill the beans on these guys. His name is Esquin de Florian. And as I say, he's an ex-knight. He had left the Knights of the Templar, of the Temple. And he appears before court and argues that that he had been forced into demon worship. That their worship includes the denial of Christ, and that the Knights Templar were full of homosexual practices. One of the things that most historians of the period point out is that the accusation of homosexual practices is boilerplate. Just throw it on everything.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to discredit somebody, you say that whether it's true or not.
Right.
Whether any of this is true or not is very doubtful. Florian is the only one who makes these accusations. He has a good reason to grind an axe personally, plus the fact that he's working for the king now. So I wouldn't exactly call him an unbiased witness, you know. He presents this evidence, or the evidence is presented to Pope Clement the fifth, and he finds it absolutely incredulous. But helping to convince the Pope is a small French army that arrives on his door to quote unquote protect him.
Mm.
So it's a little difficult. Now what happens now is a total aberration of the custom. The proper order of an inquiry is that the Pope should call together the inquiry. He himself should have the court. Now here stationed at Avignon, go through an inquisition, and I mean that with a small I.
Mm-hmm.
It is literally an inquiry, a grand jury. That's
mm-hmm.
what we would call it today, a grand jury, to see whether or not there is any truth to the accusations. If it's believed that there is truth to the accusations, then there would be a conviction, and at that point the men would be then turned over to the secular authority. And at that time, they would undergo a trial, but it's not the kind of trial we think of. It is a trial of pain in order to determine whether or not people are telling the truth or not. And what happens then is that there's torture involved. The secular government is doing, not the church, but the secular government is doing this. If you persevere in your torture, it is a sign that God has given you the strength and you are proclaiming the truth in your innocence. If you confess to the crime, then the truth has been told. And so then you're punished. If, on the other hand, you confess and then afterwards, seeing your punishment, deny your confession and again proclaim your innocence, well, that means you're a relapse and you get burned at the stake.
Oh, my gosh. There's not much win here, is there?
No, there isn't. And that is the fair way to deal with people.
Okay.
Well,
I'm glad a few things have changed.
Yeah, that's for sure. We can certainly be proud of our own system, as
yeah,
flawed
right.
as it is.
Yeah.
Better than that. Well, Philip takes the system, turns it upside down, and makes it even worse.
Oh.
He doesn't turn it over to...
Because he's
still fair. Well, that's right, yeah. Doesn't turn it over to a grand jury or the papal inquisition. Instead, what he does is he takes these knights and he tortures them right from the very beginning, the get-go. And then takes the confessions that come out of the torture, turns it over to the papal inquiry as evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's absolutely backwards. You know, Clement himself is outraged by this, but at the same time, there's not a heck of a lot that he's going to be able to do about it. You know, he's kind of caught, and this argument goes back for almost a month. What makes it all the more difficult is that the chief negotiator for the French, for the king, is Guillaume de Nogeret, who had been excommunicated by the previous pope and had never been restored, and so he couldn't speak to the pope directly. So that just makes it a little bit more complicated. Finally, after all of this, on the 22nd of November... Now, there's been over a month of wrangling that's gone back and forth. Finally, Clement promulgates a letter to the Christian world in which he praises Philip for having routed out heresy. Now, whether he believed that or not is really doubtful. Why he did it is really doubtful, too. It might be that he was trying to win the release of the Knights Templar
mm-hmm.
by mollifying the king. I don't know. Or maybe he just was a wuss. I don't know. But you know, it's just not real clear what his motivation was. But the fact is that he did it.
Uh-huh.
And then he called on the arrest of Knights Templar all throughout the Christian world. And various things... take place. There's not a uniform pattern that takes place. Throughout the papal states in Italy itself, they are turned over to the Inquisition. In most cases, they are tortured, and then they're either found guilty or not guilty according to what comes up with the torture. In some cases, they're simply the papal order is ignored. In England, the King of England, Edward II, his nickname is Longshanks. He was famous in that that film about Scotland. Remember a couple of years ago?
Braveheart.
Mm-hmm. Braveheart. Yeah, that's right. Philip II has Knights Templar in his employment and under his protection, and he protects the knights. He will not turn them over. He sends word over to the Pope and says, England has no torturers. We simply don't have anybody that's skilled in doing this. And so the Pope says, don't worry about it. I'll send you some papal torturers. And Edward says, okay, that'd be fine, but they can't use torture. So, English law, you know. And in Germany, the Knights Templars were rounded up and were underwent a trial, and they were all found to be innocent. And so none of them were punished in Germany. In Spain and in Portugal, word came back to Avignon saying, these guys are needed. I mean, we're in the process of reconquering the Iberian Peninsula for Christianity, and we can't spare anybody, so no way. And so they simply ignored the orders also. In Scotland, you also have Knights Templar there. William Wallace, Robert Bruce, they also protect the knights. And in that case, both of them were excommunicated, at least for a while, because of their denying that. The question is fomenting throughout all of Europe, and this goes on for a couple years. And finally, in 1310, Clement then calls the Council of Vienne.
Okay.
And it's basically to call for a crusade, which never takes place.
Mm-hmm.
But the real issue that was on everybody's mind was the Templars themselves. Now, Vienne is in France, and so bishops and cardinals gathered from all over. And it became very obvious right from the very beginning that the bishops wanted a strong, united stand concerning the Knights Templar, and that the Knights would be set free. The fear among many of these bishops is, if you can do this to the Knights Templar, who are protected by the Pope, you could do it to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so obviously the entire policy that had been set in motion by the conclave that elected Clement had not been fulfilled. They were not able to bring around this rapprochement with this king who was greedy and without any morals. You know, so you had that situation. Robinson says that in the midst of all of this, a very interesting thing happens. In the middle of the council itself, 7 fully armored Knights Templar rode into the council and disrupted the entire council. They were arrested by the papal guards temporarily, and then had to released.
Okay.
Okay. Eventually, a deal is made with King Philip IV. And the deal is that he could go forward with the suppression of the Knights if he himself dropped his own attacks on Pope Boniface VIII. Even after the death of Boniface VIII, his propagandists were still out there doing all kinds of stuff to slash the reputation of this previous pope, and as a result of that, also to slash the reputation of the papacy.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so that's the deal that's been worked out. However, in 1348, in March of 1348, the king finally decided to make the last final step and actually kill the general, the master of the Knights Templar. And so on the 18th of March of 1348, he gathers together an assembly out in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. There's a big park sort of area. It's a big plaza there, and he brings these men out and he sets fires. He sets them to be burned at the stake. It was incredibly cruel. The way that you normally burn someone at the stake, it was what's called using a stick fire. You take kindling wood,
mm-hmm.
and you surround the person with the kindling wood, and then you light it. And what happens is it goes very, very fast. It's a very fast what it does is, as it's going up, it denies the person oxygen. And so within a minute or so, the person will die, and generally speaking, they'll die feeling the flames, but they're going to die of suffocation more than anything else. On the other hand, what Philip does is he uses charcoal. Now, charcoal is very expensive back then because it has to be processed, and I mean, you know, think of it. It's like briquettes.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it do? It puts out a steady, constant...
Slow
heat. And so these two men are being literally barbecued to death in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral, you know. It was an incredibly cruel thing to do. And at the same time, it was a very stupid thing to do, because it meant that they did not suffocate within a minute or a minute and a half. Instead, they had several minutes in order to make speeches.
Oh,
and this is exactly what they did. Now, there are two men there. One of them was Jacques de Molay,
mm-hmm.
He's the master of the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, and also another knight who was an assistant of his. His name is Geoffrey de Charnay. And both of these men had plenty of opportunity then to make speeches. Of course, there's a crowd there of hundreds of Parisians to listen to this. It is not what the king had intended. The final words of Jacques de Molay are these. He invited the king of France and the pope to join him in death within 1 year. At that, he died. 1 month later, Pope Clement died.
Oh, wow.
8 months later, Philip died. Thus is born a myth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story also continues that, wow, that the charred remains of both of these knights were taken and thrown into the Seine River. You know that the Notre Dame is on a on an island in the middle of the Seine. They were thrown into the Seine River, and the story goes that hundreds of people jumped into the river, swam out, and grabbed pieces of these charred bodies as relics.
Relics,
And that's something.
That is incredible.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much the end of that story, or it would seem to be. And what happens is that, and this is really Peter Partner's his book, is that what he does is he shows that this myth lays dormant for over 300 years, and just nobody's paying much attention to it. It's a very unfortunate moment in church history, all that. And then, some 358 years after the burning of Jacques de Molay and the knight, Geoffrey de Charnay, there is a new interest that grows up, not around the knights themselves, but around chivalry. And it has to do with the publication of a book in 1672. And the book itself is written by Elias Ashmore. The title of it is Institutions, Laws, and Ceremonies of the Most Noble Order of the Garter.
Okay.
Pretty esoteric.
Uh-huh. You
know? He's one of the founding members of the Royal Society of London. And the deal is behind this book, and the reason why it's so popular, is that it touches the nostalgia that comes up in the mid and latter part of the 1600s, the 17th century. There's sort of a new nostalgia for knightliness, the chivalry, the brotherhood of these knights, that fraternity of knights, the code to live by, the way people dress, you know, all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, there are these moments of those romantic, in the capital R sense, romantic movements within Western culture, and this is one of those that kind of just comes up in the middle of all of that. And so, the story itself finds itself being fanned. And the story is whipped up once again by people like Ashmore, who's just a really interesting character. Not only is he a scholar and something of an historian, but he's also a chemist, an experimental chemist, as well as an alchemist.
Okay.
You know, sort of a real interesting kind of a character. And so this was real grist for his mill to do this. Now, if you take what he's doing over in England and go back over to France, this is also the time of Louis the XIV.
Okay.
He is establishing a united country that is centered on his government, and his government is centered on him. And what he does is he hires in, besides all kinds of other people, you have to remember that Versailles, the palace at Versailles, can accommodate 10,000 guests.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
10,000.
And so he has this very large entourage, and some of them actually worked. Not many, but some of them worked. And two of those who were workers were court historians for France. And they were the Dupuy brothers. One of them is Pierre and the other one is Jacques. And these two guys spent their lives working in the archives of the French government and putting together a history of France, and particularly this era that takes place with Philip the Fair. Now, what they do is they rehabilitate the reputation of Philip the Fair. Everyone who knows this man knows that he was greedy and immoral and had no bounds and lawless, all this sort of stuff. But what they do is they begin writing a history of Philip the Fair that makes him look good.
Okay.
Now, if he looks good, then who looks bad?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it has to be Clement.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so they're writing a history really that gives the impression that this poor king was manipulated by this really wily pope. But it's the absolute opposite of what was going on. But
This is the
1600s.
Okay.
Yeah. So there they are, and they're publishing all of this kind of stuff. So there's a new interest in the Knights Templar. There's a new interest in the era of Philip IV. There's an interest in knightly ways, and all of these sorts of things. Okay, add into that the kind of a bizarre twist of the Enlightenment era. As you're going into the 1600s and 1700s, late 1600s and 1700s, people are turning to reason, to science. You know, this is the age of great scientific discoveries and all this. There is this whole group of people, men and women, who pride themselves as philosophers. They're philosophers. You know the names, Montague and... Rousseau, Voltaire, Diderot, you
okay.
can go on and
mm-hmm.
on,
mm-hmm.
and Montaigne, rather. And so these men then are writing, advocating reason, criticizing tradition, criticizing revelation, criticizing religions that rely on revelation. There's a real reason snobbery that's going around among the culture elite of the day. You know, the search for scientific precision. This is the age when, you know, with Diderot, the writing of the first encyclopedia, where he goes around and he tries to find all the people who know the most about one little item, has them write an article on it, and then puts it all in alphabetical order. It's kind of a brilliant idea, really. But the idea was to gather together all human knowledge. You know, and so in the midst of all of this, there's a rejection of religion and ritual and mystery and those. But here's the bizarre twist. These same guys who all day long are professing this at night like to get all dressed up in these funny looking hats and give each other these strange handshakes and incantation words. And, you know, you got the candles and the symbols. In other words, they're inventing their own ritual, you know, as they're sort of going along. They tend to be upper middle class and aristocrats. And they've got the leisure time to play with these games. In the midst of this incredible cauldron of an interest in chivalry, in a rewriting of the history of that period, in the scientific sterility of the daily life, then mirrored by this kind of strange mysticism at night. Okay, yet all of that, you pull in a very strange individual, a Scotsman. He's a Jacobite Scotsman, so he had been supporting King James of England, who was unsuccessful in maintaining the throne. In 1736, he goes over to France, and he becomes known among the French as Chevalier, or the Knight Sir Ramsay. Chevalier Ramsay plays a very important role in the establishment of this Masonic myth. Okay? And in 1736, he gives a speech to these knight guys, you know, these knight masons. And it's a wild creation, but it really catches people's imagination. It goes like this. Supposedly, in the most ancient of times, that there were great architects who had learned from the ultimate architect, who is God. And certain secrets were passed on among the Mesopotamians and among the Egyptians. Okay? There's this wisdom. And in their architecture, they express the wisdom of the cosmos by creating a microcosm in their temples and in their pyramids. Okay?
Okay.
Now, what happens as the story goes on, and of course they create these great, the Tower of Babel, the great pyramids and all of these, the temples and all that. Now, the story goes on that at one point the Hebrews came into Egypt. Where did they come from? Mesopotamia. They came into Egypt. So they're coming in contact with these most ancient of peoples, and they learned. The patriarchs of the Hebrews learned the secrets of the universe. And so with that, after they left Egypt, they carried Moses, who was identified with the Egyptians anyway.
All right.
And they carried that back to the Holy Land. Eventually, they will build their own temple. And this will be the most important temple, of course, of the Hebrews, the Jerusalem temple, and it'll be built by King Solomon, who is, of course, known for wisdom.
Yeah. Okay.
So there you have that part. Okay. Now Ramsey continues on. So you've got this
story going.
Yeah, it is. It's a great story, and the thing is, what makes it so great is it's based on a lot of really good half truths.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So what he then argues is, and very reasonably, that the Temple of Solomon is a microcosm of the macrocosmos. Okay, so the temple, which is on the Temple Mount,
uh-huh.
right? Okay, is if you look at that temple and you understand that temple, you understand the wisdom of the universe. And the universe itself is nothing less than the temple of God. Okay.
Okay.
As is shown in the model, in his model, which is
right,
the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember that the first temple of Solomon is destroyed.
Right.
There's another temple built by the priests Ezra and Nehemiah. That temple is then supplanted by what's called the second temple, which is the one built by Herod the Great.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's destroyed in 70 AD during the siege of Jerusalem. Okay, now there's nothing there. It's just the Temple Mount and ruins, not a stone upon a stone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got all of that. And it stays that way for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, for 1,000 years. And then what happens? Along come the crusaders. These knights, these great crusaders, come in, take over the Holy Land. And, of course, one of those orders of knights then is given as headquarters the temple grounds.
Okay.
And who are they? The Knights Templar.
Mm-hmm.
The story then continues on that the Knights Templar learned from the ruins of the temple the esoteric knowledge of the entire universe. And so
they
became
they
masters of the knowledge. Okay? That made them rivals.
Oh.
To whom? The Catholic Church.
Oh, okay.
And therefore, in the 1300s, the Catholic Church suppressed the Knights Templar with the aid of good King Philip, And so they suppressed the Knights Templar in order to keep the truth from coming out,
mm-hmm.
to keep the enlightenment of mankind from coming out, so that superstition and ignorance could prevail. And Ramsey then would argue that for hundreds of years, the mysteries of the Knights Templar remained locked away, and through Freemasonry is being revealed.
Discovered.
Yeah. But you can't let it out to everybody.
No.
You gotta kind of share it amongst
the privileged information.
Sure, that's right. And the culture elite are the ones that are going to
be the only ones going to understand that, I'm sure.
I that's exactly right. So there you have it, and it it just it is very popular among so many of these Enlightenment characters to do this kind of a thing. Examples of this, I mean, get right down into some of our classic literature and class and classic music. The magic flute that is Mozart's own work is in fact full of all kinds of Masonic imagery.
Wow,
yeah,
didn't realize
very interesting.
That.
If you look at the United States dollar,
yes,
has all kinds of Masonic imagery on it. What happens then is that it doesn't. This doesn't stay idle. In the 1740s and 50s and so forth, the myth itself morphs in various ways, and the next real development, according to Peter Partner, it takes place in 1760 in Germany with two collaborators. There's a French POW by the name of George Frederick Johnson.
Okay.
That sounds like a strange combination of names, but remember that Europe in the 1700s was actually much more cosmopolitan than it had been for the next couple hundred years. This George Frederick Johnson meets up with a minister by the name of Pastor Samuel Rosa, and the two of them come up with something that can't be called anything other than a Templarist scam.
Okay.
Now, how they do this is they have what they call grades of vengeance. So that when you first enter into their group of Masons, they first of all you make a promise to avenge the Knights Templar in some strange kind of a way.
Okay.
Then it goes a little bit further. The second grade goes a little bit further. The third grade goes further. And eventually you are then condemning or promising vengeance on ultimately upon the Pope and the Catholic Church and all of that. But that happens over time. You enter into, you're given little bits of esoteric knowledge at each one of these grades. But to enter into each one of these grades means that you have to have a new sword. And, so you have to buy a new sword and you have to have a different uniform and, a new kind of turban with a little whirly bird on the top or whatever, you know.
Uh-huh.
And of course, where do you buy those things? Where do you get those things? You get them from these two guys.
Sure.
Then every time you make that grade, you then put on a banquet for all your brothers, And so you go through the admission ceremonies and you pay for a banquet. Well, these guys are just having a grand old time, you know, because they've got characters all over the place that are willing to make these sacrifices and continue on. All of this goes on. Eventually, you're going to have another real organization by a German entrepreneur who picks up on Johnson and Rosa and carries it even further. His name is Karl Gotthelf von Hund. And in the 1770s, he takes this thing to a fine pyramid scheme.
Okay.
So that what he's doing is he's convincing other members of the lodges to go out and recruit other members, and they get a certain percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Get the idea?
Sure.
And it just goes on and on and on like that. Ultimately, he's arrested for his activities. He's sent off to do time in Wartburg Castle. You familiar with Wartburg Castle?
No.
It's the one.
Doesn't sound like a bad place.
Well, it's the one that Martin Luther had spent time at when he was hiding out from Charles V, the emperor, in preparation to return back to Wittenberg. So that castle has had some interesting history in it. So 250 years after Luther's visit, von Hund ends up there instead. He's a wealthy landowner in, or had been until he ended up in prison, a wealthy landowner in Saxony, an area of eastern Germany. And he's backed by various dukes and lords and all of these sorts of things. In 1772, he had even gotten a conference, a European-wide conference set up of quote-unquote Templars that came together. These guys are claiming to be spiritual descendants of the Knights Templar. And a bunch of them show up in Prussia for this this big confab. Isn't that incredible?
That is incredible.
Yeah. 1770 or 1785, by that time you have a whole other movement that's underway. It's called the Illuminati, the Illuminated Ones or the Illumined Ones. And in Bavaria, it gets to be so dangerous in the government that the government actually suppresses it. This is 1785. It's actually suppressed. Causes widespread condemnation of the Bavarian government. There are many people that condemn the Bavarians for doing that. Even one fellow over here in the newly formed United States of America by the name of George Washington wrote a letter condemning the Bavarian government for condemning the Illuminati.
Wow.
He himself, of course, was a Mason.
Mm-hmm.
4 years later, the French Revolution takes place. And there's a lot of question as to whether or not Templarism or the Illuminati or Freemasonry had anything to do with the French Revolution. And we don't find a smoking gun here. It's not a real clear evidence. But on the other hand, many of the revolutionaries themselves have Masonic backgrounds. I'll give you an example of that. Prince Talleyrand, who had been a foreign minister both during the revolutionary period and later on, was the chief negotiator for Napoleon Bonaparte. Talleyrand himself, we've got to be truthful about this, he had been a bishop.
Okay.
And not only that, as we'll see later on as we talk about the French Revolution and the Catholic Church, he had also been a very active member of the Masons. The ideals of Masonry, as they're expressed in their own literature, often have the same vocabulary as the ideals of the French Revolution.
Okay.
The real impetus behind the French Revolution really are a whole bunch of clubs throughout France called the Jacobin clubs. And there is at least some evidence that these clubs are called Jacobin because they were first met at the monastery of Saint James. Okay, and but there's a relationship between those groups meeting there and Freemason groups that are also meeting at the same time. You have the storming of the Bastille, the murder of the king, the terror that follows afterwards, and all of this. And all of this can be seen as a Templar fulfillment of the vengeance of the Templars of Jacques de Molay against the monarchy for the murder of de Molay. Of course, we know that today the de Molay has a very special name among Masons. And he's held in high regard as this myth is carried on. One of the interesting things, I want to say something about Templarism today, but before I say that, one of our seminarians is currently working on a master's degree, and his topic is, the chosen topic that he has, is the evolution of discord between the Catholic Church and Freemasonry. And as he's looking at that, he also had to find the actual historical origins of Masons, and he's come up with some very interesting ideas. Evidently, they're available on the web. It's not any secret, but there are two kinds of approaches to Masons,
okay.
And one is the English approach or the British approach, and the other, historically looking at it, and the other is the French approach. The French approach really comes from Ramsay, Chevalier Ramsay.
Mm-hmm.
This approach buys hook, line, and sinker the mythology that was invented by Ramsay, the historical backgrounds that go back to the Knights Templar, the de Molays, all this sort of stuff, and all the various degrees that you belong, you know, the 30-something degrees. The English Masons, on the other hand, find their history, they trace their history back to actual Masonry, the building of buildings.
Okay, wait a minute. Who followed Ramsay then?
Ramsay is going to be, it's called, that's the French.
That's the
group.
French. Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I had it backwards.
And then today, here in the United States, we would see that particularly among the Scottish Rites.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the English Masons are much simpler. They've got only three or four degrees. And their historic origins are actually grounded in the establishment of Masons in the Middle Ages. Remember that in the Middle Ages, they didn't have unions, but they had guilds.
Right.
And so if you're a cobbler, okay, that'd be one thing, or a book scribe or something like that'd be another. But in this case, they're Masons. They build buildings.
Okay, okay.
Particularly churches.
Okay.
And so it's out of that guild that is then formed a social club, because by the time of the Protestant Reformation, guess what? They weren't building churches anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cathedrals simply mm-hmm. weren't being built anymore, and so they found themselves building other things. But they banded together as a social organization as well as an economic organization, and so you have that kind of masonry that continues on down today. Those are two very different understandings of the history of masonry. But it's the Templarism that is perhaps most interesting for our story, because of the myth that goes all the way back to the time of the suppression of the Knights Templar, which was in fact an actual Catholic order
right.
of mm-hmm. soldiers and monks.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to end perhaps with this quote from Peter Partner as he ends his own book on that. He says the following. It's kind of sad. He says, "The unromantic truth is that the Templars of the Middle Ages made not the slightest attempt to build a temple of wisdom, unless that temple is defined as that of the Catholic Church. The end of the Templars arose not from the operation of demonic forces, but as the result of their own mediocrity and lack of nerve. A handful of them measured up to the terrible challenge which confronted them, but most, including their leaders, at the moment of trial, proved to have nothing much to say. In the Holy Land, the Templars had been brave soldiers, but rather short-sighted politicians, who in no way conformed to the high standards of their 19th century admirers ascribed to them. The most striking characteristic of the medieval Templars was their ordinariness. They represented the common man and not the uncommon visionary. Mozart's noble Masonic opera, The Magic Flute, holds out the vision of a temple of reason and of nature, presented over by the ruler, seer, Sarastro. If the temple of Sarastro is ever to be built, and if man is to live in some state of Mozartian harmony, it may be on principles in which the Freemason ideal has had a part, but it is not based on the ideals of the medieval Templars." He separates myth from reality there.
Mm-hmm.
Another little thing to pick up, too, is a tract by Pope Leo XIII on Freemasonry, Humanum Genus. Talks about the incompatibility of the Masonic ideal and the teachings of the Catholic Church.
All right, Father, that is another wonderful show today. But I've always been fascinated by the Templar, so I'm going to have to pick up one of those books and read it. Would you give us a brief look at next week's show?
Yeah, next week we're going to go back to the pontificate of John the 22nd.
Okay.
And look at some of the challenges that he had, and particularly with the development of various heresies at the time that he had to deal with. The Albigensians.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's another group called the Poor Men of Lyon.
Okay.
This was led by Peter Waldo and the Waldensians. You have some really weird groups like the flagellants that go around beating themselves and this kind of thing. He had a lot to deal with. And if that wasn't enough, there was a breakup of the Franciscan order. And he had to deal with that also. And then in that breakup, there was a group that ultimately formed together a dissident group from from the church, from our understanding of the church as being one holy Catholic and apostolic and in union with Rome, in union with the Pope, this group tried to splinter that and really are going to lead, they're going to bury a seed of dissent that will blossom time and time again as a weed in the garden until it finally blossoms into the Protestant Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
And this really is the roots of all of this. It can be traced back this far. So the pontificate of John the 22nd, which is a long pontificate, he was pope for many years, is really important to our understanding of the development of church history.
All right. Well, that sounds very interesting. And would you close with a prayer and a blessing for us?
Heavenly Father, source of all blessings, we turn to you this day and ask you to shower your wisdom upon us, shower your wisdom upon our national leaders. Protect our troops and protect all men and women in uniform who serve and protect us, and who protect our liberty and protect our lives. We pray this glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and shall be, world without end. Amen.
The Father, Son, Holy Spirit.